Welcome to Ujiria, broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Sandy Springs, Georgia. Ujiria is a Greek word meaning health of body and mind in aging individuals. Ujiria Radio is a weekly show celebrating Atlanta's heroes that contribute to the Ujiria of Atlanta's elderly and disabled population. Now joining us in the studio are your hosts, Sam Grass and Brad Culp.
Good morning. This is Brad. This is our first show in December. I've got Sam Grass and Lee Cantor in the studio with me. Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning, Brad.
Good morning, Brad. How you doing?
Doing great. Did you guys get plenty of turkey over the holiday break?
No.
No?
Not too much.
Well, I certainly...
What about you?
Turkey? I certainly ate well. Yes, turkey. Did you guys do any shopping?
No, I don't do that. My wife did. She was gone like 8 hours the next day.
Yeah, this is crazy. My son works for Best Buy, and he had to be at work at 5 in the morning. Actually, they opened at 5. No, he had to be there at 5. He got there at 4:30, and the line was, the sidewalk is about 10 feet wide, and apparently the line was all the way down the strip center to the other end of the strip center at 4:30 in the morning, people waiting to get in. I tell you, when I go shopping with my wife at the mall, we always go through Penny's, and by the time we're through Penny's and into the inner court of the mall, I'm ready to go home.
Right, you're done.
You're more brave than I won't even get in the car with my wife to go shopping. So.
Well, this is what's funny. In my house, my wife cannot get up for work in the morning for work, right? But for somehow, at 6 o'clock in the morning on the day after Thanksgiving, she's up like, you know, someone shot her in the butt.
Exactly. Now, that's funny. Now, the interesting phenomenon that I became aware of this year for the first time, but apparently they've been tracking it for several years, is this Cyber Monday. I'd never even heard of that before, but apparently the numbers were way up this year, which I guess is a good sign. And I'm only going to give you one piece of trivia this morning. Top number one retail internet site. What do you think it was?
Amazon.
Amazon, you got it. All right. We have a great show this morning. We've got three guests. We've got Tim Young from Piedmont Hospital, 60-plus adult services. We have Kelly Dunham from Gwinnett Medical Center and Glancy Rehabilitation. And we have Wally Kellerman, who is from the Kellerman Law Firm and is an elder law attorney. We're going to start this morning with Tim. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for being here this morning.
Well, thank you for having me.
It's great to see you. Why don't we start by having you tell us a little bit about 60 Plus? So it's kind of an unusual organization, one that I've not seen replicated in many places.
Right. We are a little different. We've been around since 1987 and started out, we've kind of morphed and changed over the years, but currently we offer a variety of different services. My role is actually as a geriatric care manager. There are three of us that fulfill that role, and we will actually go out. One of the nice things about our program is we're a community arm of the hospital. And so whereas when you're in the hospital, you get to be seen in a nice sterile environment and, you know, the doctors work with you, we get to actually see people in their homes after the fact and kind of make that link to how are they really doing? Is the family really coming around every day and making meals for them like they said they would and so on? So as a geriatric care manager, we go out and we do home visits, home assessments, asking a lot of different questions, looking at activities of daily living and how well are they managing. We also look at memory testing to see is there any kind of problem around memory loss. We also do depression screens in the home and home safety evaluations. And then we work with the patient, with their family members, and with their physicians to address any kind of areas of concern that we might have noted. We have a variety of other programs. One of the things that is relatively new to us is we are doing Medicare counseling, if you will, as far as people trying to get assistance and looking at secondary policies or the Medicare prescription drug plans, which is going to be the best option for them. We have a worker who is trained in that and can walk them through that. And we have a transportation program that's available to bring people to and from their medical appointments. And then one of the other things that we do is a lot of information, education, and support around dementia. And so we offer four different workshops throughout the year looking at dementia education and support. And we also have two different support groups that we run on a monthly basis for caregivers of those caring for someone who has memory loss.
Tim, tell us about those dementia workshops.
Sure. The dementia workshops, again, one of our geriatric care managers leads those along with Sarah Carson over at the Alzheimer's Association. And they have two different workshops that they offer twice a year, usually in the spring and then in the fall. And the first workshop is kind of, now that you've been given the dementia diagnosis, now what? And it's basically an overview around dementia. What are the different types of dementia? What can you expect as the disease progresses, kind of thing? They also will typically have in that first workshop an elder law attorney who kind of helps people think about planning for the future, which is helpful. And then we also talk about a lot of issues around family feelings and as a caregiver, what you need to be prepared for and that what you're feeling is normal, kind of thing.
Can you share a little bit about, from the family perspective, what... you know, when a family member gets that diagnosis of dementia, like what are some of the questions they ask?
A lot of
Is it instant? Does it happen overnight? Like, can you talk a little bit about in and around that?
A lot of times what's happened is the person may have noted that mom seemed to be a little bit forgetful, but they haven't really realized that it was to the extent that it has now officially been diagnosed. And so... part of it is just doing education around this is a progressive illness. Usually, most of the folks that we work with do have Alzheimer's, which is usually a slow progressive decline.
When you say slow, like how is it like a year, 5 years?
No, it can be, I mean, from the time of diagnosis to death is often even up to 20 years.
Oh, wow.
So it may be a very long, gradual process. But usually the person may have had mild cognitive impairment or some early memory loss that just wasn't really picked up on. They just thought, well, you know, she's 80. We expect her to be a little bit more forgetful.
Right.
While we're on the topic of education, I know that I've seen cards come in the mail a number of times regarding caregiver education or education for either family caregivers or even professional caregivers. As we talk about Alzheimer's and dementia-related illnesses, it seems like that would be particularly important in that kind of a case.
It
Talk
really
about
is.
That a minute.
Yeah, it very much is, and that's one of the reasons why we have the workshop to educate them on what to expect as a caregiver. You know, one of the things that people often are confronted by is some behavior changes that the older adult who has dementia might experience. One of the big things that I think I see a lot is some paranoia. And it just kind of makes sense that if a person thinks that they set their wallet or their purse down somewhere and they go back to find it and it's not there, they think it must have been stolen because they're sure that that's where they put it. And the reality is they may have put it somewhere else. Oftentimes people will hide it, and unfortunately even from themselves. So a lot of times that paranoia and the accusatory type stuff is one of the things that family members have a really hard time coping with, is why is she accusing me of doing these things? Doesn't she know I love her, I'm here for her, or whatever? So a large part of our education piece is kind of making people aware of you're probably going to see some of these behaviors. There's another thing called sundowning where people will often become more agitated around sundown, much more anxious, much more hostile sometimes. And it's kind of how do you prepare yourself for that? How do you change the environment to make sure it's a calm, safe environment? You want to reduce stimulation. Don't have the TV going and the radio going and lots of people coming in and out. They need consistency. So there's all of those kinds of things that we try to educate people on.
Let's take a step back for a minute. Mm-hmm. It looks like you've been involved in healthcare and social work for a long time. How did you get into it? How did you get interested in it in the first place?
Sure. My undergraduate degree is actually a history degree, and I worked after college in an Alzheimer's unit in a nursing home. And that was really kind of where things kind of fell into place, and I realized this is really what I want to do. And I knew I wanted to work with older adults, and there was a social worker there in the facility that I talked with a good bit, and it just made perfect sense for me to go get my graduate degree in social work. And I knew, again, that I wanted to specialize in older adults. Probably my history degree is part of that. I really love hearing people's stories, and our older adults have so many that they can share with us. So that's kind of what brought me to it. And healthcare was just a natural fit.
It's interesting you said that. We had a guest not very long ago, Tim, that made the statement that our seniors are our nation's history books.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I do. I just love hearing their stories. And you know, when people are talking about coming through the Great Depression, and certainly very relevant to our times now of how do we cope, you know, they have that experience and they can share that with us.
Now, you told me before the show that your title had just changed from LMSW to LCSW. Tell me, what does that mean?
Basically, it's just another level of certification that I was a licensed master of social work, and now I'm a licensed clinical social worker. So we offer, all three of us that are care managers at Piedmont Hospital for geriatrics are also LCSWs. We can do counseling. So there's that piece of it as well.
How did you, why did they choose 60 as the number?
You know, that's an interesting question because the reality is we keep trying to reach younger and younger
right.
folks, trying to help them plan for their retirement. But I think at that point in time in 1987, it just made a good fit and it sounded good. So we went with 60 plus at that point in time. We knew we were focusing primarily on a Medicare population,
right.
which
so,
would be 65 and above. Actually, the average age of patients that we work with is 84.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. But
does it seem like there's more people getting kind of Alzheimer's and those kind of illnesses?
We do see. In fact, I was sharing with Sam the other day about how we have so many people that are being diagnosed with other forms of dementia. Used to be you would have senile dementia of the Alzheimer's type, and that was what most people thought about.
Right.
But now we're seeing many more folks and younger folks being diagnosed with frontal lobe dementias. There are various different types of dementia, and it seems like we are seeing people, anecdotally, younger and younger that are being diagnosed.
Is there any hint of a cause? Or
I think that they are certainly exploring some environmental type of issues that could be occurring. I mean, when you think about the plaques in the brain that may be causing the Alzheimer's and stuff, is it something to do with our environment and the aluminum exposure?
Is it diet-based? Is it
like there's theories around that, yeah.
But nothing definitive?
Nothing definitive at this point in time. We're still looking for, you know, what is the cause. And they're doing more and more stuff around vaccines and different trials. So, you know, they're doing research. They're, one of the things that I saw not too long ago at Wesley Woods was a presentation where they said, you know, we went from 1917 when this was first diagnosed up into the 1980s where we really had nothing to offer people. And now you've seen so many advances in the last 20 years.
Right.
So, you know, we're being very diligent in looking at this, and I think we're going to see a lot of changes.
You know, and I'm sure that is a typical market pushing the mm-hmm. research as you
right.
have the baby boomers moving in. And if you can, Tim, speak to where you see this arena being in the next 5 to 10 years.
Well, I think the market is wide open, certainly, as we have the baby boomers coming forward and approaching their older adult years. One of the things that people say all the time, their biggest fear about getting older is losing their memory. And so, obviously, that's going to be a huge focus for most people, is looking at memory and memory loss and how do we, you know, the whole brain age games and things like that. People are very invested in trying to make sure that they maintain their memory. So that's one of the things. Exercise is another big piece. I think as the boomers are coming through, a large part of it is going to be, number one, planning. The fact that we didn't think that we were going to live to be 80 and 90 years old. And now, you know, it's not unusual to have 100-year-olds. So part of it is going to be this whole notion of what are those years going to look like for me? And a large part of it's going to be preventative type of measures, making sure we're exercising, making sure we're doing those things to take care of ourselves. I think that's going to be a huge push in the future. The other big thing is so many folks are part of blended families now, and how does that affect? We used to have folks that lived in the same town as their sons or daughters who would be there as they got older and may have needed assistance. That's not the case anymore. And so, number one, who's going to help take care of me if I don't have family around? But also in a blended family, who am I responsible for?
Right. Tim, obviously you are with individuals that typically are in a crisis situation. I know at times it's got to be very, very taxing. But tell us what it is that charges your batteries that keeps you going through these issues.
I think one of the great things is what you just touched on. People are very vulnerable. When they're in that crisis mode and they're reaching out for assistance, they are much more willing many times to accept advice from us about this is a way to try to address this particular situation. And those are the things that I love, is people are really in crisis, they're needing assistance, and I can feel every day when I go home at the end of the day that I made a difference to someone's life. And that's all I can ask for. It's great. Yeah.
What does a win look like for you in these situations that are so progressive? Like, you know, what's a good day for somebody that, mm-hmm. that's diagnosed with this?
Well, one of the things I had just recently, an example, is a patient that was treated in our emergency department. She's 90. Her husband's 89. She obviously had some form of dementia, but had never really been diagnosed with anything. She was exhibiting a lot of acting out behavior in our emergency room, and I was able to make a home visit after the fact and was able to link them with so many different resources that they were clueless about. Mm-hmm. I was able to educate the husband on what is dementia, how he can communicate with her more effectively rather than having her escalate.
And then be frustrated. And
right. So there was that was a large part of it. And also engaging a granddaughter who lived in town and making sure that she realized the extent of the situation and that she needed to kind of step up
a little bit.
Yeah.
Is that a lot of what you do is help the family members step up?
It's a large part of what we do is really engaging family members and, again, physicians. A lot of times, when you see the doctor now, when you have a doctor's appointment, you're in there for maybe 5 minutes with your physician. And if they're just asking yes, no questions, they may not be necessarily picking up on anything. When we go out and do the home visit, we can come back and give them objective data of this is what we saw.
So you're kind of like the eyes and ears of the physicians.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And oftentimes we are the ones that are kind of initially hinting that there may be
something
memory
more,
loss
right.
and more to address.
Tim, based on our conversation, I already can surmise that the Alzheimer's Association and that whole cause is important to you. Are there other causes that are important to you that you'd like to talk about?
Yeah, well, we obviously as an organization do work very closely with the Alzheimer's Association, and we work very much with the Atlanta Regional Commission, the Area Agency on Aging, their aging division on addressing older adult issues in the community. In fact, I'm doing an education thing later today on understanding and negotiating the healthcare system because it's changed so much. For me personally, one of the things that I'm very involved with as well is I'm on my church's church council, and I serve on the Social Concerns Committee. So we're very involved with Buckhead Christian Ministry and a food pantry there. A coat drive right now is going on. And then we also are very involved with Lutheran Services of Georgia, which is an organization that, again, addresses hunger issues and community food banks. And we also helped bring a Bhutanese family over to this country, helped them in setting up their apartment and making sure they could pay rent for a few months.
Tim, those are great pieces of advice and good stories. Tell us how our listeners can reach you if they have questions, if they want to access resources, or whatever it may be.
Sure. Well, one of the things is, I didn't mention earlier, we also have a helpline. Our case management or care management program is a free service offered by Piedmont, so there's no charge at all. We do accept donations, but no charge for our services. We don't bill Medicare or anything. But we also, for those folks that may not use Piedmont, we do have a helpline where people can call and get information, referral type stuff. And that number is 404-605-3867. You can also go to the Piedmont Hospital website, which is www.piedmonthospital.org, and find information on that website, not only about 60+, but some of the other programs that Piedmont offers.
And how could our listeners reach you if they were interested in participating in one of the causes that you just mentioned?
Sure. My direct line is 404-605-1954, and my email is timothy.young@piedmont.org, and they're certainly welcome to email me.
Very good. Thanks
you.
For being with us
Thank
this morning.
You.
Thank you, Tim. I appreciate it. Our next guest is Kelly Dunham. Kelly is a certified therapeutic recreation specialist. That's a mouthful. She also works at Gwinnett Medical Center and Clancy Rehab as a community outreach coordinator. Good morning, Kelly.
Good morning.
Kelly told me she gets paid to play.
She just came back off a cruise. I'm not quite certain what we're going to get out of her today.
She was doing research.
Exactly.
Recreational research, right? Yeah. Kelly, tell us a little bit of your background and how you got into this area.
Well, growing up, I always was wanting to volunteer at nursing homes or co-ops or shelters, any places like that. So I always knew I wanted to work with people that were mentally challenged or physically challenged. And so I went to school at Georgia Southern University and got my degree in therapeutic recreation. And the reason I chose that was because growing up, I loved athletics, and I was very adventurous, so I thought that would take me right to where I wanted to be.
What is, in the best words that you can use, what is therapeutic recreation?
What it is we work with people with physical and mental challenges to help them go back and do the leisure skills they were doing prior to whatever has happened to them. We teach them everything from, you know, if they enjoyed golfing, we would teach them how to golf with one hand. Or if they enjoyed gardening, we have adaptable equipment to teach them to go back to doing those things again. A lot of times people come in and they feel like they can never do the things they love, and we show them that they can.
Or if they enjoy cruises, now you have the research to be able
exactly.
to support that, right?
Yes,
right.
Yes.
What, so in school they teach you, like, how to teach a golf person who plays golf how to play golf in different circumstances?
Exactly. Yes.
Wow, there's an actual degree in that. That's amazing. So what are some of the strange ways you've helped people? I mean, that you wouldn't think of, you know?
Well, at our facility now, what we have is we teach people how to get back in the kitchen and cook again.
That might be adapting, like, their pots and pans or their kitchen.
Right, and we have pieces of equipment to show them how to cut things with one hand.
Oh.
Like I said, we do gardening and golfing. We also teach them how to grocery shop again. Another big thing for a therapeutic rec is getting people back out into the community.
Doing just the normal day-to-day stuff. Right.
Right?
So what would be like, okay, say you are in a wheelchair and you have to go to a grocery store for the first time. Do you actually, like, go with them?
We do that. We do a community outing where we teach them where to park, what side of the car to get out on, like obviously the passenger side, but where to park to have enough space to get out of their car.
To open the doors to get yourself out.
Right. How to get up the ramp, getting in and out of the bathroom for the first time using a wheelchair, teaching them how to ride the electrical cart. I mean, all of us, we don't use those things until
right.
something like this happens.
Sure.
You know, we want them to feel confident where they're out if they need assistance. To ask people, the workers there, to help them, how to reach for things. Because if you're in a wheelchair...
Yeah, how do you get the high shelf stuff?
Well, we have an adaptable reacher that they can reach for things. Mm-hmm. And we problem solve. We teach them how to do things that they normally would not
can
be
you
doing.
Take us through that? Like, say you have a person that first time you're taking them to a grocery store, and I'm sure they're, like, dreading it, right? They're, like, nervous.
Very nervous.
So how do you, like, kind of walk them through? Can you share a story maybe that...
Well... We always tell them that people are going to be looking at us because we're in our scrubs.
Right. That's a tip off. Something's happening here.
and for the first time, people are going to be aware and looking because they've never had to have a walker in a wheelchair. And that's most people's, concerns is they feel uncomfortable because they're different.
Right.
So we want to give them that confidence when they walk in the store that,
it's okay
to do this. And another thing we always, tell them that, people want to help. Everywhere we go, we always have, you know, employees that want to help us. People are aware that you're there, so they watch out for you. But we also have to be aware, too, because there's children around that aren't paying attention. We surely wouldn't want to run them over with an electrical cart. you know, we have them go to the store and find things on a list. They make a list of items, and we teach them now to shop by aisles versus making a
list. Roaming around.
Right.
You don't want them to do that.
Well, they'll be exhausted.
Right.
In the end. And you don't realize how big a grocery store is till you get there and you're having to walk it or use an electrical cart. So it's a lot more problem solving for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
What are the events that might bring someone to Glancy Rehab?
Well, we are a CARF accredited rehab center, so our specialty are stroke survivors. So we have stroke survivors, we have brain injury, and we do see every other disability too, such as if someone had needed knee replacement or hip replacement, multiple injuries, you know, from a car accident or motorcycle accident, back injury, everything.
So you get it from all different angles here.
Yes.
And tell us, is Glancy an inpatient facility, an outpatient facility? Is it both?
We have an inpatient facility. It's a 30-bed facility. They're all private rooms. And then on the other side of our building, we have an outpatient rehab center as well, which we have a transitional fitness center there. So anybody that is out of rehab that would like to exercise or do get some more therapy without being able to go to a therapist. We have a gym there that's set up by a physical therapist that gives them an exercise program, and they can feel comfortable working out with other people that have deficits.
So your specialty is stroke. Walk us through how, you know, somebody has a stroke. What is the progression of activity? What happens? Somebody's got a stroke. They go to the hospital. They end up at Glancy. What happens next?
Well, our goal there at Glancy, well, I guess I would say for my goal would be when I go in, I like to find out what their interests are, what they were doing prior to the stroke, and what's important to them to get back to doing. We want to, you know, whatever side they're weak on, either left or right, we want to work on building that strength back up. I mean, our main goal is to get, we want them to walk out of Glancy when they leave, and we want them to feel like they can be the person they were before. At Glancy, we have a stroke peer visitor program where we have peer visitors that go through the, we actually do it at the Glancy Center, but American Heart Association has a peer visitor program, and we train them to come back, our stroke survivors, to come back and visit patients that just had a stroke to show them that you can get through this. And it's a support for the family, a support for them. That's probably one of our biggest programs because we want them to know that they can conquer this and they can get through it.
Yeah, having visited that stroke support group before, what struck me when I did visit was how important that was in seeing people that were survivors, particularly people that have just had that happen to them. Maybe tell us a little bit more, because maybe not everybody listening is familiar with what is a stroke and what are the signs. I know there are a few basic signs, you know, when somebody is having a stroke that you can look for, and what do you do?
I go out and teach educational classes on the signs and symptoms of stroke in different communities in the Gwinnett area and assisted living. Some of the signs that to look for are if you have weakness either in your arm or your leg, blurred vision is one, slurred speech is another one. And the other thing is that strokes don't hurt. So a lot of people think, well, I just feel funny, so I'm just going to rest and see how I feel better, because it's not like chest pains or something you've got to get to the hospital for. That's what people feel like. They don't feel like it's an emergency. And I always recommend to call 911, because if it lasts longer than 5 minutes and you still have weakness on one side, right, and you're dizzy.
Because that time is a factor.
Time is a factor. There's a 3-hour rule that, you know, that our hospital would like you to get to the hospital, because there's medicines that you can take, a TPA medicine that they can give you at the hospital to help decrease the deficits.
Now, isn't stroke and a heart attack similar in a lot of ways?
Well, stroke happens in the brain.
Right, but is it the same thing that's happening, the little clots going to different places?
Your heart, it happens in your heart. And the brain is a stroke.
Right.
And in terms of, as a family member, when you're looking at somebody that's having a stroke, what might be some of the clues? They're some of the same, I guess.
If you are watching someone, you could tell by the weakness in their arm. You could always have them raise both arms. And if one arm won't stay up like the other one, that's a sign. Any balance issues, if one of their legs give out, if they're standing. Another one is slurred speech. You know, if they're not making any sense or word finding, right, you notice that they're, you know, all of a sudden they're just not making any sense.
So it would be like gibberish, or they would just be saying the wrong word?
It could be
either one.
Mm-hmm. Or one side of their mouth is drooping.
Right.
You know, confusion.
And so if this is happening for 5 minutes, you got a problem.
Yes, after 5 minutes.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So this question, you might look at me and say, I don't know where to start. But we asked Tim the same thing. It sounds like you've got an incredibly rewarding job. But tell us what really makes your day.
I guess for me, what makes my day is going in and working with the patients. It's important that, you know, every day that they realize they're getting better and they can see a progression in them every day. And since we see our patients, you know, we see them every day. From the next day, we always tell them, look how much you improved today. It's important that they you know, see that. And we enjoy seeing that because to us, we see miracles every day walk out of Glancy.
Kelly, I'm sure that in your professional career, you have certain organizations or causes that you feel close to your heart. Can you speak to those?
Yes, I am in charge of a stroke peer visitor program, which I told you about earlier, and we do that in March, and we team up with the American Heart Association, which is also, they have a branch called the American Stroke Association as well, and every month I hold a stroke support group, and it meets every second Thursday of the month from 6 to 7, and my
And where is that held?
It's at Glancy Rehab Center.
What happens at a support group meeting?
We have speakers that come in, educational speakers, and mm-hmm. they speak for about 30 minutes, and we have someone different every month.
Is it for the stroke victim, or is it for the family, or both?
It's for both. It's both mm-hmm. the stroke survivor and family, because it's good for everybody to come that's a part of it, because everybody's living now with a stroke.
Right, they're all dealing with
mm-hmm.
it.
Right. So it's a great support system, and really for us, we call it our bragging rights, where they get to come and tell everybody how they've improved.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it's important to us too, because we also have our patients that are in the rehab center that are there now.
They can
inspirational
for them to see
yes,
that
very
people
motivation.
Do get better,
right?
Not lose hope.
I think you have a specific story for us too, right?
Yeah. I'll jog your memory
about a football player.
I have to brag first about one more.
One
more association. The Gwinnett Senior Network Provider. I'm the treasurer with that, and that consists of people in the community that are working with seniors. We have about 120 members that meet, and you can go on our website at gspnonline.org. I think it's gspn_online.org.
I'll put it in the post when we get it. I think it's gspnonline.com, but we'll figure it out. Actually, Sam said here that you're the treasurer of GSPN, and I know you're the treasurer, but you're also the treasurer.
Mm-hmm.
So
I love to take the money. Plus, it's fun, too, because the money that we collect over the year, we donate it to the community and to take care of our seniors. And then I guess a story that we want to talk about. This is not a stroke survivor, but this was an amputee. And it was when I first started working at Glancy Rehab about 4 years ago. He was one of our patients there. He was 19 years old, and he was hurt in a football accident.
Oh, an amputee from a football accident.
Yes.
That's unusual.
Yes. So when he came in, of course, he was very depressed. And he was very young, and he just felt like his whole life was over. That was it for him. And with all the therapy that we offered and with all the leisure skills that we showed him that he could do with one leg, he is now actually back at school in Michigan, because that's where his accident was. And,
mm-hmm.
and he is now going to school for some type of sports medicine.
Wow. So it was just the beginning. It wasn't the end.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Terrific. And if you were going to give our listeners a piece of advice, what would that be?
My piece of advice would be, if you are going into a rehab center, either you or your family, do the research on the rehab center. Find a rehab center that specializes in your needs.
Now, at Glancy, is it, do people come from all over?
All over.
Wow.
We've even had people come from the Virgin Islands.
Really? So mm-hmm. it's known worldwide?
Yes.
So while you were on your cruise, you were marketing
recruiting.
All right.
If you get hurt on that rock wall, here's my card.
Kelly, how can our listeners reach you?
My email address is kdunham, it's D-U-N-H-A-M, @gwinnettmedicalcenter.org. Or my direct line is 678-312-6167.
Very good. Thanks so much for being a part of our show this morning.
Thank you, Kelly.
Our next guest is Wally Kellerman, someone that I've known for quite a while. Good morning, Wally.
Good morning, Brad. How are you?
I'm doing great. We're just pleased that you're here with us this morning.
Thank you for the invitation, and good morning to you, Sam, and good morning to you, Lee.
Thank you.
So, Wally, you came to the law profession in a bit of a circuitous route. Tell us about that.
Well, I was a registered nurse for approximately 41 years. I actually spent 38 years at the bedside, but part of that time I was also a lawyer. Interestingly enough, I come from that era where you were either a housewife or a nurse or a teacher. So I took the nursing route, but very quickly found out that I wanted to be a physician. Unfortunately, I was married with two children, and you know how that is. How do you do both? You can't. Mm-hmm. So I aspired, went to school all the time. In fact, I still go to school. I've never stopped. I decided what I would do is become a nurse practitioner. And that was during the Reagan years. And when I was accepted, the president of the hospital called me and said, Wally, I have good news and bad news for you. And I said, what's that? He said, well, which way do you want to hear it? I said, well, give me the good news. He said, you've been accepted into the program to be a nurse practitioner. I said, well, then what's the bad news, sir? He says, Reagan closed the program. So there I was, having really worked hard to get to that point. And so I worked a few more years, and one day I sat at a chamber breakfast next to a sister. I still remember her well, Sister Marie Celeste Allen. I said, Sister, who was an RN, if you had to do it again, what would you do differently? She said, I would have become an attorney. I said, an attorney? Who'd want to become an attorney? Well, long and short of it is I spent the day at the New York State Nurses Association. They all said, you've got to do it. We need nurses in the profession. You can join the American Association of Nurse Attorneys. And that was the beginning, and that was in the early 80s.
Are there a lot of nurse attorneys?
Lee, I think we probably have several hundred in the country. It's not a huge organization, but more and more nurses are leaning in this direction, yes.
Why do you think that is?
I think a lot of nurses are like me. They've outgrown their profession. They want to be able to combine their skill sets in such a way so that they can still use some of that nursing while using the law. And for me, the nurse is always sitting on the shoulder. It is a combined practice.
So why is it unique? Obviously, there's not that many of them, but why is it important for us to have nurse attorneys?
Well, for example, in my practice, I get a lot of calls from families who will say, the doctor has told me that we need to go to court to get a guardianship or a conservatorship. And my bias is that's the last place I'm going to send my family and my elder. I'm going to do everything I can protect my elder from not losing the right to make their own decisions. And the nurse in me is able to say, okay, who is your doctor? What are the symptoms? You know, in other words, we go through kind of a medical assessment, and we get them lined up with the right people. And I would say 8 out of 10 times it's going to be because not because they need to be declared incompetent, but because their medications need to be managed differently. They need to be away from just a general practitioner, and they need to be in the system where they can be properly diagnosed. As we've heard this morning, we have many more systems available now for this, but many people don't realize how to get into that system. And so this is why I think, in my case, being a nurse has made a difference in many families' lives, because we don't immediately want to put them into a courtroom setting.
Do you miss anything about nursing?
I absolutely do. I hate to say this publicly, but I'm going to. Not all lawyers are as ethical as I think the medical profession generally is.
What about nurses? How's their ethics?
I think generally nurses really work hard at doing the right thing.
So that's kind of sad, right? That the lawyers don't are
well,
more like nurses?
Well, how shall I say that? What I'm trying to say is a lot of lawyers, and we've been trained to do this, so it is not a criticism of the profession. We are trained to do what the client asks. And many a lawyer will say, well, that's what my client wanted.
So that's how they rationalize?
Yes. And I am not going to sit there and do something that I don't think is in the best interest of the client or the community.
With that, Wally, won't you tell us about your firm, your focus of in that firm, and give us what a life in the day of yours is?
Well, it all started back in 1993. You know, I did go to law school outside of Boston and spent 3 years in the profession. That wasn't good enough, so I came down to Emory and took an advanced degree, and I do have an LLM in litigation. So when I started my own practice in 1993, I really thought I would be doing mostly trial work. But when you have your own practice, everything walks through the door, you know, everything. And it didn't take me very long before I realized there were just some things I wasn't interested in. So please don't bring your criminal matters to me. I can't help you with a DUI. But when the elders called, obviously, I didn't know what to do for them. And I'm very frank about that. I tell all of my clients, at 1993-94, when you asked me a Medicare question, even though I was a nurse, I really didn't know what to do. So then I went looking in Atlanta to find people, and there wasn't anybody. We had no elders. It was interesting that we did not, at that time, geographically and demographically, have elders. So I lobbied for the Yellow Pages, and we now have a state bar section, and we have all of the basic bar, you know, have something for elders. So in terms of my practice, I fell into elder law. And what started out as a general litigation, business law practice morphed into now being elder law, general civil litigation, and business law. And general civil litigation will be things like personal injury, medical malpractice. Business law, of course, can be breach of contract. And elder law is kind of a combination of many of those things. As I say, I actually have helped a couple elders with their speeding tickets. It's not my...
It's not a specialty, but...
It's not my favorite thing to do, but they can't do it alone. And I figure if they can't do it alone, I, as a lawyer, should be able to help.
Wally, excuse me, won't you give our listeners a couple of examples of the type of cases that you handle?
Okay. In terms of elder, let's talk a little bit about the elder. I'm doing a lot of asset protection planning these days. We do, of course, estate planning. And estate planning is taking a look at assets, helping people decide what they need in the way of a power of attorney for finances, an advance directive for health care decisions, a living will. But the question doesn't end there. It's, okay, where do we go from here? And I'm the conscience of my families. I'm asking the hard questions. What are your plans for the future? You know, we wish you long life. How do you plan to pay for it? Where are your resources? What are your values? Do you want to spend the money on yourself? Do you want to spend some of it on yourself? Do you want to leave some to your children? And then working with our families to figure out what it is that they really want and plan ahead. So the estate planning side of that includes that elder law type conversation. That can go anywhere from, I need a divorce, sometimes, very rarely, but occasionally, to, you know, planning for aid and attendance, planning for use of Medicaid maybe sometime in the future, or maybe none of that. I mean, I had an elder that came in the other day, this is very rare, who had $5.5 million. And we were trying to figure out how we could keep some of it from Uncle Sam. And so it could be given to local charities. So the range of activities is extremely broad. Now, in terms of an example for an elder, about 2 months ago, I got a call from one of our local assisted livings explaining that they had a woman, an elder in a wheelchair, who had a court date. And the court date had to do with the fact that she had owned a home and had squatters in there. Her brother had actually put family members in her home, and she was getting ready to go home. So she needed help to get her sister and nephew out of her own home. And so we went to court.
And you assisted her through that process?
And we assisted her through that process, and then she did get to go home.
Assuming
and stay
you were
in
successful.
Her. We were successful. Good. Other types of successes are again, the conservatorship, the guardianship, and talking about Wendy's program here, we have oftentimes we will have young people who will have been in a very serious accident of some sort and can no longer manage their health care decisions. They're over 21. But they have money. Maybe they've gotten a personal injury settlement. And there's somebody other than parents that need to manage. We had a young man who had a conservatorship and a guardianship in the state of Georgia. And these are fairly rare, but we actually went to court to get those removed. And with our blessing, he then became independent. He still needed assistance. He still needed to live in more of a protected environment. He had to relearn how to spend money, just as Wendy and Tim have explained. But we were able to get that removed from him. I recently filed a medical malpractice case. I obviously, for confidentiality reasons, I have to be careful about what I say about such cases. But we're about to embark on a personal injury case for an elder who was riding in a car and was seriously injured. She did survive it, but she's going to have about $350,000 worth of damages, but she survived it.
Do many medical malpractice cases come your way? I know it's not probably what you enjoy, but I would think it's such a natural.
I am a wonderful gatekeeper. In other words, I tell people we're only 109 years from washing our hands. And when I worked in the hospital, I really saw malpractice every day. But malpractice has to do with damages. You know, if somebody makes a mistake, are you really damaged? Or is this something else? You're mad because the physician didn't treat you with the greatest of respect. You know, the bedside manner sometimes is brief and short. So many of the cases that I do hear about are not cases at all. They simply have had terrific complications. So in terms of me being a gatekeeper, what I say is I protect the medical profession as much as I can. But when a case comes along that it's obvious that there has been an error, then we go to bat for that person. I take maybe one a year.
Wally, I know that you recently had the opportunity to experience our healthcare facilities from the inside.
Mm-hmm.
Give us your observations about having been a patient in one of these facilities.
For our listeners and for our readers, I was struck down by a motor vehicle September 4th of 2009 while walking in a crosswalk going to a lawyer's breakfast meeting. I spent 8 days in the hospital. I did survive that. And I did have a broken right leg, which could not be repaired. I just had to go through the rehab. And so I spent almost a month in one of our nursing homes. And I it's sad to say, but we are still to some degree back in the 60s. And I just wish our legislators could spend a couple of weeks in a nursing home and could see. There's a law that says there's 2 hours of hands-on care for a person in a regular nursing home. There obviously is more time in a rehab setting. But if I didn't know how and what to do for myself, I would not have improved as quickly. And our elders simply do not have the ability to recover as quickly as the law wants them to, for example, Medicare and things like that. So it is important that when someone is placed in a setting like this, that they have a good support system. And that support system, I cannot stress, is absolutely imperative. And let me tell you, I had a geriatric care manager get me out of the hospital, into the nursing home, and out of that nursing home.
And that speaks to Tim and his organizations
right.
and those out there. Yeah.
And I think it's important to say that, you know, we already talked earlier about the fact that RNs and healthcare professionals really want to do the right thing.
Right.
But there are issues that are preventing them from doing that, you know, in terms of being able to staff a facility properly, et cetera.
Right. And, you know, we have to speak to this as long as we're talking to an elder law attorney. You know that the inflation rate has gone up steadily, and everybody expects it. It is not unusual. The medical debate right now, we do know, is extremely costly, and we do know that there's a lot of fraud, and we do know that that needs to be fixed in some way. How that's going to be fixed so that people are not put in danger, I don't know. That is an open question. But what most people don't realize, and what saddens me, and what I fight every day, and, you know, I go out and do these lectures, is that the cost of long-term care has fallen off the planet. We have no concept, as boomers who bring their parents to me at, you know, at the 98th hour, you know, help me, help me, help me. And it's like, where were you 5 years ago when you really had more options? So to our public, you know, I go and teach these classes for free. I know both of my cohorts here are willing to do it for free. And you know those classes will have 5 or 10 people. Mm. You know, it's very, very much that we are not going to get old. We're never going to get sick. We're never going to die. It's and if we do plan, then we're going to cause our own. It's a myth.
That sounds like a perfect lead-in to a piece of advice for our listeners.
The piece of advice is several. One is, aging is risky business. Don't go it alone. Find yourself a team. If you call the lawyer can get you to the geriatric care manager, can get you to the CPA, can get you to the financial planner. None of us are licensed to do the other's job. All of us have different skill sets, and every one of us is really there to be part of a team approach. Personally, I'm the surgeon. You go to your GP, he says you've got to go have your thyroid out. You go to the surgeon who takes your thyroid out. Where do you go after that? Back to your GP. I'm the surgeon here. You come to me, I do the law work. But very often, that's the last you need of me. But who do you need? You do need your geriatric care manager. You do need your CPA. You do need your financial planner. If you're a person who has injuries that needs continuing rehabilitation, do it. The second piece of advice I guess I would give is really do check on who is providing those services. There are, I won't say they're charlatans, but that, and that's an old-fashioned word, but there are a lot of people out there trying to make a dollar who really aren't as skilled as other people. And so you want to go to a reputable business. You want to find out, you know, whether or not the person, for example, a lot of attorneys are not elder law attorneys, and they do give advice that may not have been in, you know, exactly right for someone. So make sure that they do go to see an elder law attorney. If they want to go to NAELA, NAELA.com, National Academy of Elder Law Attorneys, they can find an attorney anywhere in the country. I get calls from people out of state all the time. They can find me on the NAELA website. So it's the idea that we do have people that have been vetted, have extra skill sets. So I would recommend that people find the services and recognize and look for those that are well qualified to help them.
Thank you. And how can our listeners reach you, Wally?
Well, the quickest way is to call me directly, which is 770-736-0369. 770-736-0369. They can email me at attynwk@aol.com. We do have a couple of websites. Kellermanlaw.com is really ready to be redone. If you want to learn a lot more about me, you can go to nolo.com. Look for Find a Lawyer. Look for Gwinnett County. And they've stuck family law under, they've stuck elder law under family law, but you will find me there as N. Wallace Kellerman. And there's no R in my name, by the way. It's K-E-L-L-E-M-A-N. Thank you.
Well, thanks again, Wally.
Thank you, Wally,
being here. And thank you to all of our guests for being here this morning. Thanks to our listeners for tuning in. You can hear this show after the fact at www.ugeriaradio.com. Remember, if children are our nation's greatest assets, seniors are our nation's greatest treasure. Tune in at the same time next week for another great edition of Ugeria Radio.
Ujiria Radio is sponsored by Griswold Special Care and is recorded in the Business Radio X Studios.